Access number 30631, Mr. Herbert Landsberg, Real 4. Now, what was a typical day like at Kitchener Camp? What time would you get up?
Reveille was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and the sergeant major, his name was Woulard. He was a professional soldier in the First World War, and he was recalled in the Second to deal with the Territorial Army and the changes from the Territorial Army to the Active Army. And we were never quite sure if he liked us foreigners, but he used army language which some of us had never heard of before.
Now, so you're a valley, you got up, and what would you do next?
After Reveille, you know, in the wash house, of course, and all this, breakfast had been prepared by the cooks, of course, much earlier, six, because, and what they used huge washing, you know, in the wash house, things cleaned out properly, we hoped, and made porridge and everything in it, and very basic food. And after that...
Now, what would the training be then?
It was the basic commands like stand to attention, at ease, and left, right, left, right, left, right, marching in groups, in sections. We were detailed into 10, 12 sections of about 15 men to 8, 20 men each. And it was pretty, you know, considering that we had joined, you know, all of us were volunteers in those days, in the early days. And we had volunteers hoping we would be issued with rifles and be sent to France as soon as possible. Well, we were sent to France within 6 weeks after basic training and route march and route map reading.
How did you take to drill? You know, I mean, you'd never done it before.
Well, some thought it was a waste of time, and they put a brave face on it, because if you were critical at all, Woulard came down on you like a ton of bricks. And
what did you think of drill?
I thought it was excellent that you learned how to cooperate with other people of quite different origin, different language, different cultures, and to make it into one sort of homogeneous type of fighting unit.
Now, what other training would you do, say, in the morning or in
this
session?
Then they asked for any craftsman, anybody who was, say, a professional manual worker, and they were given saws, pickaxes, and all the usual tools that they needed in their trade, in their previous trade. But a lot of them were doctors, medical students, and musicians. The musicians were immediately taken out, and they formed a very good orchestra and gave nightly performances in a big hall just to keep the spirit up, because some of them got very depressed when they couldn't see more than a half a dozen rifles in the officers' quarters, and there were not enough rifles to go around to everybody, and there was certainly no firing drill.
So you didn't have any weapons training?
No weapons training in those days. A little later on.
Now, hang on. So you weren't a tradesman. So what were you doing? You know, you drill. What route marching? What else were you doing? Any other
map reading. We did a lot of map reading, and
how did they teach you map reading? I mean.
They had very good instructors for that, and also uh, Maps really? Oh yes. Then those who are under the age of 40 were given physical drill, you know, boxing, hand-to-hand fighting, and that was very popular with those. And the over 40s wanted to join it as well, but there weren't not enough space, not enough instructors, and so they had to mark time, as it were.
Well, did you enjoy the physical training, the PT and the boxing?
Oh yes, it was essential, because a lot of them were came from professions where they've been sitting on in the offices or in the surgery or whatever.
What about you? Did it make you fitter?
Oh, I enjoyed it, because I didn't think I was really fit enough, but I enjoyed all the physical training, because by about March or so, March roughly, I felt much fitter than I was when I joined the army.
Now, any other aspects, any other training you did?
Oh yes, then those of us who were really determined to get to a rifle were given some training, and some knew how to handle, and they were all First World War rifles. There was nothing modern about it, no Sten guns or any of the new type of weapons.
And how did you do at rifle training?
I did remarkably well on the rifle range. I still got upstairs somewhere, or possibly here, the three bulls that I achieved in three shots. And of course, before all this, you had medical, and some were turned down and sent home. And I had a strange experience. One of my toes, my little toe,
on your left foot,
is slightly curved over the next toe, because my parents or my mother wasn't very careful when I was getting my first shoes. And so the MO said, "Well, I'm afraid you won't be able to join the army. You never get army boots on to do this." So I said, "Well, I'm determined to get into the army, and why not let me try it? Right, I'll give you a chit paper, and you go to a quartermaster sergeant's office and to a store and get a pair of army boots, and come and see me in a week's time. Walk about as much as you can, and you probably beg me to let you go home." And it was murder. It was blood all over the place, blisters and everything. I was nearly disheartened to the point of saying, "Oh, perhaps he was right. I wasn't fit enough." And after the week, I went to see him. He said, "Well, was I right?" I said, "No, they're as comfortable as my ordinary shoes." "You bloody liar," he said. "Look at it." And he looked at it. "But you're determined," he says. "But I can only give you C4, which is a very poor state of health. But you can work yourself into A grade, A1, if you really work hard at it." And I did. After the first week in France, I was and I saw my papers, and I noticed the C4 was crossed out, and it had been increased to B grade and eventually A grade.
Now, any other training at Kitchener Camp that you recall, or any other events?
Oh yes, every day we had 2 hours in the morning and sometimes 3 hours in the afternoon, marching and running and hand-to-hand fighting, and of course a lot of the chaps did small mistakes, were immediately given kitchen fatigue for a week, or had their pay stopped. And I was lucky. I got in the first few 6 weeks before we went to France, I was given no penalties whatsoever. It's when after going over to France on the boat, I was given my first.
Now it was 6 weeks you were at. So when did you go to France?
It was shortly after Christmas.
That would fit, yeah. February, in January.
Yes.
Because you joined in December. So what do you remember? I mean, what did they tell? Were the whole unit going?
The whole unit went on to it was a troop ship. We went straight over to Rennes and preparing fuel depots and ammunition depots for the army, who was then, of course, very close to, already stationed in France.
So that's where you went to. You were based in Rennes, or Rennes?
Rennes, yes. Rennes, Brittany, I think it was.
Now, where were you based in Rennes?
Some French army barracks. Very comfortable, except the food was not English army food. We were given a lot of French army food, which we were not used to. But
what was it like?
Well, it was all right for people who had been traveling abroad a lot, but to many of us it was unusual food. Tremendous lot of potatoes, very little meat, sausages or fish, and then for those who were confirmed vegetarians, they were all right because there was lots of salad, but it wasn't enough to keep a bird alive, you know, let alone a man.
What were the barracks like? Can you remember?
Ben?
What were the barracks like that you were living in?
They were a bit derelict. Water came through the roof, and we had to sort of patch it up. But it gave us something to do. You know, it was nobody grumbled about that. We made them quite habitable. There weren't enough blankets to keep us warm because January was a very cold winter that year, and. But we thought that's one of the sacrifices we have to make.
And now, tell me a bit about the duties you were doing. What were you actually doing? What do you remember of working mainly in the port area, I presume?
I was in a loading party. That means you had to unload equipment from the station at Rennes and take it to the building site, and then get down to work. And it was piecework. If you did finish your allotted amount of digging or preparing, you could go off duty instead of 5 or 6 at night. You could go off duty 4 o'clock or so.
Now, what were you building?
We were building or preparing a runway for planes, an ammunition depot, well, that means flat ground and superstructure on top to store things, especially fuel for the tanks and the mobile equipment. And yes, that was the main thing. It was.
What was the work like? How hard was it?
It was very hard for some of us because we weren't used to manual work. But nobody complained because we were told this was for the national effort, you know, and that was the reason we had joined. But of course we had joined what we thought to be an infantry regiment. It was really a labor regiment. At that stage,
was it tough?
But we also had a rifle range quite close, and those of us who had good eyesight and had experience I had experience as a young man, and with air rifles, so it was nobody could complain that we were being spoiled or neglected. If anything, we weren't used to the hard work, and in the evening, very few could left the camp to go to the local pub. Because they were too dog tired.
It was really tiring.
It was tiring, yeah.
So you didn't go out in the evening?
No, I didn't, but quite a few did, actually, but not many were in a fit state to go out in the evening.
Now, tell me, you'd been promoted, you'd been given your first
stripe on a ship going over, and nobody knew why Landsberg suddenly was Lance Corporal Landsberg. They didn't think much of me as a non-commissioned officer, NCO. And
why had you been picked out, do you think?
The only reason I can think of is I was the only one who could speak not only English, but French as well as German, of course. It was my mother tongue. I imagine that was the reason why one of the sergeants sort of took a bit of notice and passed it on to the sergeant major, and he passed it on to the orderly officer, and they said, oh, there's a vacancy for Lance Corporal. I think this bloke might be okay. He speaks a few languages, and he's willing. But nothing special. I didn't do any special to deserve it.
What was your role as Lance Corporal? Was it much different? Did they use your linguistic abilities, having picked you for
it? Well, it was to see that the beds were made, you know, the palliasses were in good shape, and that everybody was ready for work at certain times. It was more disciplinary type of a promotion rather than a military one.
And you didn't get to... Did they use you to translate with the French much? Did they use you to translate French?
Oh, yes. Especially when they made girls, and they wanted me to write a letter for them, you know, because they couldn't say much in French themselves. But also, I used to go out with a ration wagon when we went to go collecting the rations for 280 men from the army depot, and if there wasn't enough there, we had to go to the marketplace and bargain with the locals, you know, on market day. And that was useful then, that I could tell them more or less what we needed and what the people wanted to pay and what we did not want to be to pay.
How did you get on with the French? I know you didn't go out drinking in the evening, but I mean...
The chaps didn't get on very well because I couldn't speak to them, and the French were very suspicious when they heard all these foreign languages, Hungarian, Czech, Slovak, and German spoken. And that was, of course, the same prejudice they found in Kitchener Camp. The locals there in the evening resented us, those of us who only spoke either German to their mates or their local language.
Now, so this is during the Phoney War. Anything happened, any incidents you remember before May when the German attack starts? Because you were there about, 4 or 5 months, you know, before the... Four months.
Yes. Of course, we had to repair a tremendous lot of structures because Germans came over, you know, when they realized there were landing strips being prepared and depots. They didn't know whether it was fuel or ammunition or food depots. And so we had to do a tremendous lot of repair work.
Do you remember the German air raids?
Oh, very well, practically every day.
Now, when did this start? Later on, or all the way through?
Very early on, when they realized that the front line, you know, was far beyond Dunkirk into France, and then the French, of course, when they surrendered, when Hitler.
Now, but that is May, June.
Yes, May.
Is that when their German air raid started? Or did they start in January when you got there?
Oh, in January we had air raids practically every day.
Now, what were those air raids like? What do you remember of them?
Well, we were told to take shelter as soon as the observation plane came, say an hour before, and it was realized, you know, that within an hour or so, a whole squadron of them would be overhead. And there was no anti-aircraft battery anywhere near us to help us. So we were sitting ducks, really.
Now, what aircraft were they? Were they bombers or low-level strafing?
Oh, no, it was just bombing and destroying structures rather than going for the men or the rest.
Were you caught up in the raids? What do you remember of them? Or were you in the air raid shelter?
To us, it seemed no. We didn't go run into shelters. We just had tarpaulins, and that was about the only thing. And of course, quite a few were killed. Quite a few were injured, and the hospitals were full. You know, and we had a field hospital from the army, and then that was overflowing with small injuries, shrapnels and things like that. Or when the roof fell in of one of the buildings, you know, a lot of chaps got injured. And It was really a good experience, I would say. If it was active service, this was active service.
Do you remember what? Now, so once the raid had been, you'd repair the damage. Do you remember that?
Oh yes, we prepared it as repaired it as best as we could, and of course it was. It was ridiculous in a way, because within a few hours it was down again. They realized that there was no defense on the ground, and so they came down for low-flying and machine gunning anything that moved, whether it were French civilians or British Pioneer Corps.
So what's the next thing that happens then?
Well, then suddenly we heard that the French were not all that keen to continue with the war, but that was mainly army news. You know, when we got the London BBC, we got more information than through the army sources themselves. And so we realized there was
This would be late May.
Yes, it was retreating, and they were concentrating on Dunkirk to be evacuated back to Britain. And they were very lucky. They had a Polish Air Force and Polish tank drivers, which had escaped from Poland when Germany and they were wonderful in backing up the defense of the British Army. And some of our sections were suddenly sent there to help them to stem the German advance.
You weren't.
Staying behind, as we were close to some of us, were close to one or two ports near Rennes, not very far away.
Now, there's a story about this, isn't there? Because you actually recommend Saint-Malo. Can you tell us the whole story?
Oh, yes. Then suddenly I was sent with one section to Dunkirk to help them there to defend the port. And the major came with us, Major Gordon Smith. And after about 2 weeks there...
So what do you remember of happening at Dunkirk?
We were on the beaches there. We were not able to do much. Just build underground shelters for ourselves and for any other units that had to concentrate there to wait to be taken out to the ships.
Where were these air raid shelters?
On the beaches, very close to the beaches, between the beach and the sort of hinterland.
What sort of air raid shelter?
So
you were building these air raid shelters on the beach. What was the situation? What do you remember? What could you see on the beach? What do you remember of that period?
Well, it was just... we could see one or two small British warships sending boats in and taking men off the beaches.
Was the beach crowded?
Oh, it was crowded with men. And as soon as the observation plane came over, and we knew within half an hour or so there would be a squadron of fighter bombers overhead. And everybody had to...
Now, was that strafing, or was that also high-level bombing?
Oh, it was fairly low bombing. We had anti-aircraft guns all around us, British aircraft guns. And the Polish fighters were wonderful in their planes, you know, to keep the Germans not at bay, but, I mean, not to sort of... get right down and do tremendous damage in human lives.
And how did you feel? I mean, were you nervous? Because, I mean, you were, you know, worse for you if you got captured than most.
Well, we thought that if they broke through and took of the 200,000 men which were crowded around there prisoner, then the outlook for the war continuing would be very small, very bad, especially as Chamberlain was still then the sort of peacemaking type of prime minister. I think as soon as we heard that Churchill had taken over, our spirits went up wonderfully. Because we knew he would never make peace with Hitler, whom he had met and realized what a devious bastard he was, and of course dangerous to an unknown high degree, high level.
Were you nervous in yourself? I mean, were you scared with all this bombing and the rest of it, or were you all right?
Well, we were worried mainly.
Were you nervous?
Well, not so much our own lives, but what would happen to our relations and parents, you know, and family, that everybody had family there. I mean, even I had my father, mother, and sister in London, but most of them had extended families, you know, either in south of England or around Manchester and that area. And then one day the major said, well, does anybody know, I believe I mentioned it, a beach.
No, they can't see this. Tell us the story. So you were still at Dunkirk when this happened?
Yes.
And what happened? The major, this is Major Gordon?
Gordon Smith. He said one day to the us and COOs, you lads, corporals and corporals and sergeant, does anybody know a beach that is a bit further west, where we would not sort of stand as it be, like sitting ducks picked out and picked off sooner or later, every one of us. and nobody put his hand up except me, and the Navamis said, I know San Marlo very well. And so I mentioned, and they said, well, how is it? And I explained that I was teaching some English kids whose grandfather had a house in Dinar behind San Marlo, and I had to take them there every day swimming at San Marlo, and it would be a wonderful beach because the boats wouldn't have to come into the port altogether, a mile out. It was a very shallow type of approach, and we could be together with some English sections who wanted to join us.
Now, I'm not quite... I thought you were at Rennes when you suggested this, because Rennes isn't far from St. Malo, but you're saying it was Dunkirk that this happened, that you recommended this.
Yes, it happened. It's at Dunkirk. You know, he said, is there anybody...
So you weren't going to go off at Dunkirk. Why not?
We wanted to get away from Dunkirk because we weren't much use there. They had enough defences around it to keep the enormous number of British soldiers safe.
So had you gone back to Rennes?
To where?
Rennes.
When?
Had you gone back to Rennes?
To Rennes? No. He said, now how can we get to St. Malo? I said, well, I'll go to French railway depot and see if I can get an engine driver and a couple of half a dozen cattle trucks, and we take anybody who can be released.